Curtis Hill clashes with the Holcomb administration over gender changes at the BMV, a potential GOP challenger for Holcomb, plus the third Democratic presidential primary debate and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending September 13th, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world. Working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Attorney General Curtis Hill threw up roadblocks for a new rule that would make it easier for Hoosiers to change their gender on their driver's licenses. The BMV has, for years, allowed Hoosiers to change their gender on their license with a doctor's note. The issue came to the fore, though, this year when the BMV began using a non-binary gender option, X, as prompted by court order. That caused a brief firestorm in the General Assembly before Speaker Brian Bosma shelved the issue. Now, the state agency is trying to create a rule that formalizes the process, allowing the gender change with either a revised birth certificate or special Department of Health form, and the health department will allow people to change their birth certificate with a physician's statement. But Curtis Hill's office objected. The arch-conservative attorney general says the rule didn't go through the proper public notice process. Where is this issue with gender changes on licenses headed? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, I would be pretty surprised if the General Assembly doesn't get involved here, no matter how this shakes out in the rulemaking phase. So will that make things better?
No, I don't think so.
But it usually does.
Yeah, right. You know, if you look at this like a lawyer would look at this, who is aggrieved if the rulemaking process wasn't followed? Exactly. I mean, who's affected? Who's hurt?
The public, who didn't get a chance to weigh in.
Oh, nonsense. All he's doing is appealing to the radical right of his party to show that he doesn't like transgender people any more than he doesn't like LGBT people in general. So that's all he's doing is it's a political statement to try to show that he is more right-wing than anybody else in the party. And it's obviously going to embarrass the governor, whose BMV was prepared to go ahead with this. So it is just a political stunt on Curtis Hill's part, not the first, not the last, probably, of the stunts that he's pulled, in disregard of what his real function ought to be in that office.
This is, Ann sort of points out, this is another occasion of Curtis Hill and Eric Holcomb, or at least Eric Holcomb's administration, butting heads. Does Curtis Hill come out on top on this one again?
Well, I don't think he's coming. He's not really coming out ahead.
I was thinking about the marriage plank amendment, but yeah, there's other issues there. I don't know. He's still the attorney general. I think he's coming out okay
so far.
Look, I mean, in Curtis Hill's defense, this is his role in this process, in this rulemaking process, to verify that the process was followed. And if he feels like it wasn't, and it's not uncommon for rules to be pulled back at this point in the process, but he does have the option to use process to affect the underlying policy decision here, which is what the governor is trying to do, which is, you know, the BMV has been able to make determinations on gender on your driver's license since 2009. The court directed them to have this X option. So Governor Holcomb is perfectly in line with what his good government, you know, a great taxpayer value mission right here is to say, okay, what's the best way to do that?
I believe he calls it a pillar.
Well, it is a pillar. And so he's loyal with that pillar and consistent with that.
Step.
Consistent with that
it's
pillar
next
in this.
The next level.
It's consistent with that pillar in that they're trying to determine who best to make this decision. What they determined was, rather than have BMV clerks in 92 counties at the BMV branch decide that your gender changed, maybe health officials at the Department of Health should do that in a confidential way for the people that are asking for it. And so that's what ultimately is going to have to move forward here. Now, whether that moves forward is a matter of legislation or rule, I guess, is from a procedural standpoint.
Yeah, that's forward is a matter of legislation.
Yeah, that's the argument from the Holcomb administration. Do you think a lot of lawmakers are going to be okay with that explanation?
Well, I think in the short term, the argument that the rulemaking process needs to be followed probably carries the day. I mean, it would be hard if this ended up in court for a judge to say, well, these rules are just sort of meant to as a suggestion, you know. I mean, it's pretty clear cut. And if that wasn't the case, well, then there's probably grounds to delay or reconsider.
Who has standing to raise that?
Well, any, I think, as a legal matter, probably any citizen of the state of Indiana.
What's the harm to the citizen of the state of Indiana?
It didn't have an opportunity to weigh in. I'm not arguing this. I'm just saying that.
Good.
But it's a fortunate. But aside from that, we can't divorce the technicalities from the broader issue, which is the political considerations. I'm guessing that if the Attorney General had had the option of, if everything had been done, all the I's
exactly the right way.
Just the right way, there might have been some disappointment because there wouldn't have been this opportunity to shine a light on the law and to find a way to object in a way that undoubtedly plays well to a certain portion of his base constituency.
Of course, the irony there is in not going to this more thorough process, confidential process, we're left with the easier process of changing your identity and your driver's license,
I mean, whether I'm downloading the State Department health form that my doctor fills out or the BMV form that my doctor fills out, I mean, the BMV clerks are still going to get the form. It's just a State Department of Health form. There's not
the
a
right
lot
state
of
agency
which is
that,
why which is why it seems likely that the legislature gets involved in 2020.
Yeah, I mean, they will definitely get involved because they want it to be that you can only change your sex if you go to court and actually amend your birth certificate through a court order. And so that is
which is the process right now.
Well, no, right now the BNB does accept
change your birth certificate right now, you have to get a court order. And this proposed rule would also change under a proposed policy of the Department of Health.
Well, not a rule, but the State Department of Health has said they would also start accepting the same form to change their birth certificate without a court order.
As I've said,
all this is designed just to make it as difficult as you possibly can for people to indicate what their choices
of
gender are.
They're actually making it
easier. The state is trying to make
it easier. You have to go to court. I'm not talking about what they're trying to do. I'm talking about what Curtis would like to do.
You just have to go to the Department of Health now.
Just an aside, I've mentioned this before, and it's kind of a quirk, but there are thousands, tens of thousands of Hoosiers.
With no gender.
And I am one of them. Well, I have a gender, but if you look at our birth certificate.
Not on your birth certificate.
Not on my birth certificate. The state of Indiana did not put at least the documents that were issued or released by
there
the
wasn't
clerks,
always consistency.
The county clerks, and that's created some consternation, but it happened for decades, I believe, in the state of Indiana. Yeah. So, you know, if we get to the point where you have to only use a bathroom that corresponds with what's on your birth certificate, there's going to be a lot of people hopping around.
Well, you can go to court and change it, too, because that's really convenient.
Well, you've got to figure out where the original document resides.
Well, speaking of Governor Eric Holcomb, he could get a primary challenge next year after an Indianapolis area Republican this week filed paperwork to run.
Brian Roth runs a leadership consulting firm in Carmel, an affluent Indianapolis suburb. He filed paperwork for a gubernatorial run with the Indiana Election Division, though he's not commenting on his potential bid. Roth's website touts 30 years of experience in the U.S. Navy and the private and nonprofit sectors. The central Indiana businessman faces an uphill battle to even make it on the ballot. Candidates for governor must secure 4,500 total voter signatures, 500 from each of Indiana's 9 congressional districts.
Michael Bryan, I want to start by asking a conflict of interest question. Indiana Republican Party Chairman Kyle Hupfer is also Eric Holcomb's campaign manager. Doesn't that, on the surface, present a conflict of interest in exactly a situation like this?
No, I don't think so, because I don't care who decides they're going to run for governor in the primary. The Indiana Republican Party's number one job next year is to reelect Eric Holcomb. We restructured state parties so that there was no daylight between the governor's campaign operation and state party. They raise money together. Operationally, they operate in complete tandem. The conflict of interest would presume that Kyle Hupfer has different interests serving both of those organizations, and that's not the case. The ballot access question here is a relevant one. I mean, it's not unreasonable. I don't think it's an unreasonable threshold to get on to say you have to have 500 voters sign a petition in each congressional district. It proves that you've got a base level organization, and that it also ensures that we're not one of these states that have 10 pages of people running for governor. You're trying to find the one legitimate candidate. So the governor's campaign and state party have a large staff, we have a lot of resources, and we've been working 4 months to meet that high bar. And we're almost there, and it's really a tough threshold. You kind of wake up one morning and decide you're going to run for governor when you've never done anything really before, maybe even voted before 2016.
Not that you checked.
Not that you checked.
I don't want to make this seem like it's just one party who would do something like this. Any state party is invested in its standard bearer.
Look. If you have the governor's office, the state party is a wholly owned subsidiary of the governor's office, period, end of discussion. Doesn't matter what party it is.
Right.
Okay? So, in not conflict of interest, he's there to protect Eric Holcomb. Okay? If this guy gets on the ballot, or if he gets close and it comes down to a state election board counting of the signatures, I think the result might not be the same as it was in the senatorial contest the last time around. They may not be there, because it would be in Eric Holcomb's interest not to have any opposition, not to have any businessman out there saying, we're not interested in the right wing of your party, we're interested in a more progressive business approach, which you're not showing, because you're not showing any leadership in that position. So it would be interesting, you know, I wouldn't be at all surprised.
The conservative wing of the Republican Party would be really happy to learn that Eric Holcomb's not a moderate.
I think that the conservative...
that he doesn't appeal broadly. He doesn't have a 60% approval rating in Marion County.
He may appeal broadly to the conservative wing. He may not appeal as broadly, because he isn't doing what he should be doing on education, to the business wing. So you've got that...
You are living in another universe right now.
You've got that possible dichotomy up there.
If someone's going to primary, if someone's going to mount a serious primary to Eric Holcomb, it seems
it's probably not this guy.
Navy former Navyman, business-oriented Republican
is
who Eric Holcomb is.
If I can finish the point, it is not uncommon for Republicans to restrict access. That's what Donald Trump is doing by shutting down primaries and caucuses in state after state after state to make sure he's guaranteed the.
We're not restricting access, but we're not going to turn. We're not going to. Just because this guy woke up and decided he wants to run for governor, the state party all of a sudden goes, well, I guess we're out of it. We'll see you in May.
I don't expect
I want to ask
the
about...
The question was, would there be a conflict if it came to a choice between certifying all of those signatures, if he gets there, and not? And what I'm saying is that the state chairman is going to err on the side of not certifying.
If he came in and... You're just making things up.
I want to ask about the ballot access question, because Indiana revisited this issue in 2016 when Todd Young got real close to not quite making that 500 signature threshold in a single district. And we asked the question of legislators and legislative leaders at the time, is that threshold too high? And they, to a person, pretty much said, after looking at it, no, we're fine with it.
Oh, yeah, I think everyone's fine with that threshold. And it's not going to be easy to make, especially for a person who, look, I don't know this gentleman. He responded to an email and said that they were putting together a video. I have no idea what side he's going to come at or what his issues with Eric Holcomb are. He appears to have no political experience. So I think to meet that would be incredibly hard for him.
Is it too hard? Should we have it relaxed a little bit to allow, somewhere between 4,500 signatures and 10 pages of candidates?
Well, one would presume that if you are desire to be the chief executive of a state of 7+ million people, you probably should have the smarts or wherewithal to collect 500 signatures.
Or at least the organizational skills.
Spoken by somebody who's not ever tried to do it.
Yeah, stood outside of Walmart in December.
I'm not saying it's exactly.
I'm
not saying it's easy, but you do look at states, and Mike alluded to this, where you basically just turn in a form and you're on the ballot.
And maybe pay a fee.
Mickey Mouse or, yeah, it's... I don't know what the correct threshold is. You know, would lowering it to 400 or 300 be? I presume that if you're going to, there's not much difference. If you have a structure in place, an organization and a grassroots organization in place to get signatures geographically distributed throughout the state, the difference between 300, 400, 500 is immaterial.
I once collected signatures on Super Bowl Sunday when the Colts were in the Super Bowl. I was like, I got invited into a lot of parties, but it was like the least popular guy ringing the doorbell.
All right, well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, which we will be asking a few times between now and next November, will Governor Eric Holcomb win re-election in 2020? A yes or B no. Last week's question, should e-cigarettes be included in Indiana's statewide smoking ban? 84% of you say yes, it should. 16% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Democratic presidential hopefuls met this week for their third primary debate, this time all together on one night.
The debate between the upper tiers of Democratic presidential candidates was at times contentious, particularly early on during a wide-ranging discussion of health care. It was a segment of the debate that yielded this moment, perhaps the most eyebrow-raising of the night, between Julian Castro and Joe Biden.
Barack Obama's vision was not to leave 10 million people uncovered. He wanted every single person in this country covered. My plan would do that. Your plan would not.
They do not have to buy in. They do not have to buy in.
You just said that. You just said that 2 minutes ago. You just said 2 minutes ago that they would have to buy in. You said they would have to buy in.
Their grandmother would not have to buy in. If she qualifies for Medicaid,
are you forgetting what you said 2 minutes ago?
Be in for it.
Are you forgetting already what you said just 2 minutes ago?
South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg didn't get as much airtime as several other candidates, but in what was one of his clear standout moments, the Hoosier Democrat attacked President Trump's trade wars.
You know, when I first got into this race, I remember President Trump scoffed and said he'd like to see me making a deal with Xi Jinping. I'd like to see him making a deal with Xi Jinping.
John Schwanis, this was a more important moment for Pete Buttigieg than the last two debates because it was one stage with all the top-tier candidates. Did he stand out enough?
I think he had a solid performance. You know, I've said before, you can't really win a debate. You can only lose it through gaffes or blunders or misstatements. Or at least that used to be a death knell, maybe not so much anymore. But he didn't do any of those things. He acquitted himself, I think, quite well. Talked about his lifestyle choices in an open way that I thought...
It seemed to resonate.
It seemed to resonate. He took a fairly moderate approach on, for instance, the public option in terms of health care and some of these issues. Was not a bomb thrower, and to the extent he did unleash any attacks, what I think did make him stand out to a certain extent was that he wasn't attacking the other people on the stage, but as has been the case throughout this debate season, he focused his attacks almost exclusively on the current occupant of the White House. And that's it certainly is a departure from what we saw from most of the other candidates up there who it's getting increasingly heated, and apparently that's what the handlers of these candidates are saying they need to do to stand out and get that breakthrough moment. But at some point, you wonder how much of that baggage will linger.
It seems to me that when you look at coverage of last night's debate and you see people talking about the biggest moments, whether it was contention between two candidates or things that certain candidates were saying, didn't feel like Pete was really making those lists.
No, I went through like 10 or 12 articles this morning from various outlets to kind of see who, and he wasn't making the good list or the bad list. You know, he handles his questions well. He's very articulate. He's very thoughtful. But I do think there's this point we've seen now for a month or two where, you know, you got to kind of wonder if his campaign has hit a plateau or think about what they can do to sort of kick it into another gear.
Yeah, but it feels like increasingly the narrative around the Buttigieg campaign has become, well, you know, in all three debates, it's solid performances, but nothing to really make him stand out. And he raised all that money, he outraised the field, and what is he doing with it? It's not showing up in the polls. Has he hit a plateau?
I don't think so. You know, when you look back over the course of history and you see how many, quote, front runners wind up with the nomination, it's fewer than you would think. So what happens now is as we get into the early caucus and primary states, yes, he has to break out, but he doesn't have to come in first, as we know. And those are where the money that he has and is his demeanor, which is absolutely solid and calm and obviously intelligent and articulate as well. He's not trying the little cutesy things that some of them tried, and he's not being confrontational with fellow Democrats. I said the one thing that's really amazing about watching that performance, and I watched it from beginning to end last night, was that I would be happy with anybody up there in the White House except the current incumbent. All
of
them
were solid.
And that is certainly
the message that some of those candidates were trying to provide
all of
the
them
night
were solid. I don't agree with all of the ideas they've espoused, and I don't think all of those ideas that have been put out there will be part of the platform for the Democrats, but I do think that they showed an ability to be presidential, and we've been missing that for the last 3 years.
Obviously, Pete Buttigieg had his big breakout moment like right at the beginning, like in those first few months between forming the exploratory committee and actually launching it, and where he catapulted into this upper tier of five or six candidates, but it feels like that's just where it stopped Is there room left to go? Or obviously there's room left to go. Will he make that next jump?
Yeah, we're going to find out. I mean, he did a great job fundraising. There's no doubt about that. I mean, he was out kicking Joe Biden, right? So that is not nothing. I mean, he did a wonderful job pulling all that money together. He's hired a lot of staff. He's put out a lot of field offices in Iowa and New Hampshire, which matter in Iowa and New Hampshire more than being on TV or any of the things that matter in other states downstream. But I mean, if we get into the first or second week of October and he's still kind of at 4%, I mean, he starts to become a more appealing Department of Interior candidate.
Look who was ahead of the Republican primary in 2016 in September or October.
We can't all.
No, it was Rudy Giuliani who didn't even make the cabinet.
Well, look at the other Democrats, too, who have, quote unquote, broken out. They've almost to a person done it by attacking Joe Biden, as opposed to just being smart and being well thought. And so one must wonder, it seems to me, what payback is there, whether you're vying for a cabinet position or whether these people do end up getting the nomination, what kind of ill will is out there, and there's I doubt Joe Biden is going to be as enthusiastic.
He sort of endorsed Cruz.
Yeah.
I
think the assumption with Biden is that his early lead was name ID driven.
That's what it is.
But we've been saying that for 6 months, and now we're on our third or fourth debate, but it does keep dropping.
Away from the election. You know, I mean, Giuliani was leading in your poll at
time. We're really like 4 months away from the election. I mean, the momentum starts moving pretty fast.
The state wants to shield a lot of information from public eyes in a class action lawsuit against the Department of Child Services.
New York-based group A Better Childhood filed the lawsuit on behalf of Hoosier foster children. It argues, for instance, DCS fails to provide stable homes for kids and moves them around too much. The state wants court filings in the case sealed and redacted. It says children's confidential information is otherwise at risk. A Better Childhood agrees that children's and family members' names and locations should remain confidential, but it argues, for instance, analysis from an expert based on those records shouldn't be sealed. The group says it's important the public learn how DCS handles children.
Nikki Kelly, this isn't the only move the state is trying to make in this case, is it?
No, I mean, they filed a motion to dismiss, which is a very customary thing to do. But also they want to halt discovery until there's a ruling on motion to dismiss. And my favorite is that if by chance the lawsuit goes forward, they want to separate every child into their own lawsuit, you know, because not every child is the same. And I think they're just trying to sort of spread it out so that you can't really see everything.
To that point, it doesn't seem likely that the court would... I mean, usually you see courts desperately wanting to consolidate cases. That's already happened here. Is the state just trying to... I mean, just doing what it does to try and put this off?
It's probably run out the clock, yeah, to a certain extent, or hope that there's a loss of enthusiasm. Because, again, the stated intention is to protect these vulnerable young people, and we can all agree to that, but we have... The discovery rules are in place for a reason, and our judicial system and our tort system is set up for a reason, and just because it might hurt feelings or cause some discomfort isn't really a reason to throw things out the window.
There is a balance, and A Better Childhood says there should be a balance between the obvious confidentiality that needs to happen in terms of names and locations and things like that, but the reason they said they filed the lawsuit was in part to put this in front of the public. So why is the state
was DCS
trying?
Not in front of the public? Was that a box we needed to
check? I mean,
the balance point, there's a line to draw here where you're just allowing them to have access to whatever information they want or what you're allowed to keep confidential. The tone deafness of this lawsuit, and whether it's a serious effort or just a PR effort, remains to be seen. But it's just it probably would have been a better fit 2 years ago. We've put so much time and money and effort and attention into DCS, and it is moving the right direction as a result of that.
No one's arguing that they haven't improved, but don't you think it's fair to see if they're still, whether they're doing their job well or not?
No, I don't, Ann.
Because the problem with that is we hear this, that they put so much money and they're doing so much better, but yet we're not allowed to find that out. If it seems to me if they are doing so much better, they'd want to put that information out. The plaintiffs on this are saying, absolutely, what's confidential stays confidential. But the expert reports and all, we want to see that you're doing what you're saying you're doing and what it is you're not doing that ought to be done.
They want the stories out there. as much as possible without names and identifying information.
Yeah, they want to show what's happening to kids, not with their name or their photo, but more than just a number.
Right. All right, well, finally, we got our first look this week at the Indianapolis Colts without Andrew Luck on the roster, losing in overtime to a Chargers team many expect, honestly, to contend for the AFC title. Panelists, can the Colts make the playoffs this season? I'll start with you, Ann.
Of course they can. They only got into the overtime because Vinatieri had a bad day. We all have those.
Yeah, we don't bank on those from Adam Vinatieri
too often. No, very often.
Do you think the Colts will make the playoffs?
They can make the playoffs. I'll tell you who might not make the playoffs.
The Chicago Bears. Yeah.
I'm doing everything I can. I'm wearing my orange tie, my blue coat.
All right, well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.